Pack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. The Top Chef Judges Table is back here at Reality TV Wrap-Ups. I am Antonio Mazzaro, and I am absolutely, positively thrilled this week to be joined by not one, not two, but three of my favorite co-hosts here at Reality TV Wrap-Ups. It's Mike Bloom, Kurt Clark, and returning to the Reality TV Top Chef Judges Table, it's Josh Wiggler. Guys, how are you?
Yeah, Josh won so many challenges in last podcast kitchen, and he finally earned his way back onto the podcast after all these weeks.
I'm on fire. I'm back. I'm not back. I guess I'm premiering. I'm debuting. I'm here.
This is it. You're peacocking. You're popping out. This is like you're seeing your shadow. What?
Yeah.
What, Mike said you won all these challenges. Josh, what was the toughest podcast challenge that you had to do to get back in the game here at the Top Chef Judges Table?
Oh, man. Toughest podcast challenge that I had to do was probably, I don't know. I wish I had something witty to say.
True Detective season two is, I think, probably.
That was tough. That was tough.
I remember that on-air challenge where you had to cover all of season two of The Strain.
Strigoi. That was probably the big one. Also, probably trying to wrangle Antonio when he was getting really angry at Fargo during our season two podcast. That was tough.
That was a special challenge. That was. Yeah. I understand. I made it very difficult for you.
Yeah, pretending to like The Walking Dead during the first half of this current season was a little difficult.
Well, you earned your way back onto the Top Chef Judges panel. Here's your metaphorical jacket. Welcome back, Josh.
Thanks,
we're happy
man.
To have you.
Yeah, I'm glad you're not giving me any knives. That would be bad for everybody involved.
Yeah, I mean, I heard you had a really interesting battle with an apple earlier, so I don't want to knife you up, as it were.
Yeah, keep that away from me. For your safety and mine.
Kurt, are you happy to have Josh back? You're a little quiet here. I feel like you may be a little upset.
I'm reserving judgment.
Fantastic. I mean, look, we should judge Josh only on his contributions to this episode and not what he's done in the past. So
yeah, it's a podcast by podcast basis, right?
It really is. It's a blank slate. And I really podcast by podcast, blank slate. Josh, I would like to kind of start this podcast off with just kind of your quick take, 30 seconds on this season as a whole. We don't need to get into names or specifics unless you want, but just generally speaking, what's your kind of quick take on Top Chef this season as opposed to previous seasons?
My quick take would be, and I'm glad that you're not asking me to get into names because I'm having trouble latching on to names this season.
Just say Angelique and you'll pretty much
Angelique
be good to go.
That's good. I'm a little out of it on Top Chef. I did some catching up this past week. I did the binge on Top Chef. I hadn't been watching week to week. I really like it. I think that there's some really talented chefs in the mix. Some of the personalities are popping pretty well, but a lot of the people that I really like are gone. I was a big fan of Giselle. I thought she was great TV. I'm sad to see Big Dougie go this week, aka Wesley. So a lot of the people who I liked are gone. So that makes me sad.
So no, with the nickname Big Dougie, are you inferring that Wesley is a larger version of Doug from last season?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's what we call him in the Wiggler Fox household. It's Big Dougie's back on TV. Oh no, Big Dougie went home last night.
Big Dougie, I'm sure that's fine. Yeah,
we were rooting for Big Doug.
That's preferable to Corcino, I think. So we're probably ahead of the game if we're calling him Big Dougie.
Yeah, I like this season. It's a shame that there's only two women still in the running here. It's very much a sausage party this season of Top Chef.
Yeah, but I mean, after May's win last year, I don't know. I feel like we're going back to a typical norm on Top Chef here,
yeah,
unfortunately.
So. Yeah. Yeah. The Knicks of Top Chef world are reigning supreme again, much to Kurt's delight, I'm sure.
Go, Nick.
Yeah, it is tough because we saw kind of a bloodbath this week with two people going home, Angelina and Big Dougie, aka Corcino, aka Wesley. But you're right, Josh. It is kind of interesting that we're down basically to Karen and Marjorie among the female chefs. We've seen a lot of the other female chefs kind of go home in rapid succession. So it is an interesting shape up that's happening. I don't think that the gender makeup of the remaining chef testants will influence any of the decisions that the judges are making, but maybe the listeners can check us in the comments. I'm wondering, is there a season where we've gone to only one sex of chefs left, at an earlier point? Do we see Marjorie or Karen really floating or cooking their way to the end here? Is this Karen's coming out party this week? Are we going to see Karen really in the top the rest of the way here? I mean, Kurt, what do you think? Do Marjorie or Karen really stand a chance of carrying us all the way to the final three here?
It's funny when you talk about Karen, because we did see that scene in the middle of the show where she's talking about how she's sick of, maybe not sick, but she wants to see somebody other than Kwame or Jeremy win the elimination challenge, and then she comes ahead and wins. And I wonder if it's kind of indicative of how Top Chef is edited, is you don't necessarily get a winner's edit, as you're more likely to get an edit for who's going to win that particular round. So when Grayson won, we wondered, I think at that time, is this indicative of her like longer term story in terms of going all the way to the end? And it definitely wasn't. But you know, Karen's on my team. I'm pulling for her. I think she, one of the first things mentioned in the first episode was that, she's up for a James Beard Award. So I think that, she was one of my first round draft picks. So I'm definitely thinking there's some potential there.
I like Karen. I think Karen's got a shot. I think that she's got a real good shot. I mean, we've talked before on past Top Chef podcasts about how, unlike a lot of TV, like you can't really predict based on editing or right. storytelling on Top Chef. That doesn't seem to be super important in terms of figuring out what the outcome is. But if you are factoring that in at all, I feel like there is a story being told with Karen, and she seems to be a dominant presence this season. And I think that, she did make that comment in this past episode where she's like, it's time for me to come kick some butt. I'm sick of seeing these two guys win all the time. And then she goes ahead and wins that challenge. So I think that there could be more to Karen's story. And I'm certainly pinning a lot of hopes on her, even though she's not on my team. But at this point, I'm not even rooting for my horrible team. So I gotta start rooting for somebody else. So Kurt, I'll back you up.
Josh, yeah, your team was chosen, robotically.
By Skynet, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Skynet screwed you over, maybe because you're working with the Resistance. Yeah. It's because you have Chad left in the game. And Chad had a pretty good week. We found out a little more about Chad, who had been pretty, non-existent on the show previously. But the only other person you have is Angelina, who just survived her way through Last Chance Kitchen, even though she got her ass pretty much handed to her.
She's got no shot. It was, it was really just a matter of time before she was going to get clipped on the show anyway. And it's just a matter of time before one of these people who's currently on the show goes to Last Chance Kitchen and knocks her out. So I have to hang all of my hopes on my hanging Chad here. That is literally the only thing I've got left is big bearded Chad. Otherwise, I am completely out of this.
Yep, so if go ahead, Mike.
I was gonna say, so if you could like do it all over and you had a pick of any of the chefs that were left on any of our teams, do you have like a clear number one in your head of someone you would want on your team right now?
Who would I want on my team right now? I like Kwame a lot. I think Kwame is good. I like Jeremy. This could be the year of Jeremy's just dominating reality TV. I think one of those two would probably be my bet. I know Antonio loves Isaac, but after Bananas Gate, I'm not sure that I would back that horse.
Kurt, you've got Carl, Karen, Wesley, and Giselle, and you lost Wesley this week. Giselle is gone, but we were talking a lot about Karen. Would you trade Josh Carl for Chad?
Oh, hell no. Carl was actually my first, I had back-to-back picks in the draft, and I chose Carl and Karen, but, even though Karen was first round, Carl was always at the top of my list. I think I even debated between Karen and Jeremy when I had that Karen spot to pick. So, unfortunately, and I would not going to swap at this point.
Yeah, it is interesting. Mike, you're saying that we learned a little bit more about Chad this week. He definitely had kind of a home court advantage being in his city of San Diego. Didn't help him earlier in the season when he got to cook Mexican. That was a bad day for Chad, but this was certainly a good day for Chad. And I think he certainly acquitted himself well, probably better. And along with Chef Amar, I think better than we've seen all season from Chad. So maybe the arrow is pointing up for Chad. Josh, maybe you still have a shot here.
Maybe still have a shot. As long as he knows all of the guest judges' palates as well as he knew this week. How do you know somebody's palate? How does that work?
I mean, maybe he like is maybe that like an app for that?
Yeah. What's the means of knowing someone's palate? Do you just
maybe he knows the guy's orthodontist, and that's how he knows his palate?
Is it just like he sloppily makes out with these people? He's like, all right, I know your palate now. I know what to feed you.
I know you like the taste of hot stuff.
Yeah.
And that even might be how that works. The man horse strategy on Top Chef is really an understated one, but Chad was able to use it to full effect this week.
It's a good strategy. It's working.
And I think even if you look back at that pop-up restaurant challenge where Chad, was really only, and Jeremy were only saved by the graces of Kwame, is like, I'm wondering to what extent there was like, when Jeremy gets enthusiastic about something, he gets enthusiastic about something. And I wonder if his overconfidence at that challenge maybe rubbed off on Chad a little bit. So I think, if that had been a different chef in Jeremy's position there, I wonder if Chad would have maybe, you know, thought things through a little bit further, would have potentially, you know, cooked a better dish. So I'm even wondering to what extent there's a contamination effect for Chad's almost loss in that pop-up challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I mean, Chad seems to be a chef to monitor going forward, not as much, obviously, as Karen, who really did have her kind of moment where she stepped into the beard, if you will, this week, where she really proved kind of what she's on the show for and really stepped up in terms of her cooking. So she's clearly the winner of the episode and really of just where this episode marks in the season. But this was a good day for Chad as well. It's also, I think, a decent day for the man who's been the lightning rod on this podcast and probably in every part of the community of watchers of Top Chef this season, and Chef Philip. Josh, what are your thoughts on the man bun, bearded, plating snails on rocks, Philip, Chef Philip from Los Angeles?
This is a special agent, Philip?
Yes, this is special agent Philip, not plating on rocks.
Yeah,
he is kind of a specialist.
He sort of is a specialist.
Certainly special.
I was mad that that Philip got to stay the week that Giselle got knocked out when he had like the mushy potatoes, and I was really
gummy.
Yeah, the gummy potatoes, and I really liked when Jason called him out. Jason, who, you know, I don't know if Jason's in any position to be calling anybody out after the squid meatballs this week. What did he say? This is the grossest thing. He's like, you know, soft on soft is a really and just when you describe something as soft on soft, I'm out. You know, you don't want that. That sounds texturally awful. But I liked when he called out Philip, and I really thought that Philip ought to have gone home that week instead of Giselle. So I was mad about that. But that being said, his opinion of himself and the way he describes himself, he's like, doesn't anyone want yummy food? He's such a dork, and that makes for good TV. So I'm glad to have him around. I really don't want to see him succeed. I feel like his time is coming up sometime soon. But for now, he's entertaining enough to have on the show. But I think that he's got a real overblown opinion of himself for sure.
Yeah, I'm actually starting to feel bad for him a little bit, if I'm being honest. I think this week softened him in my eyes. He's a hungry guy. He's really trying and working very hard to do the things that he's done in his life and to achieve, whether it's on Grocery Games or whether it's on Top Chef. Philip's giving it his all. I heard, by the way, guys, I don't have we can put a link to this in the show notes. It's out there somewhere. He wrote a screenplay about his life.
Of course he did.
Oh, man.
Yes.
Is it a horror movie called Gummy Potatoes?
So this is his version of the Costa Rica job, basically. He really is following in this other Philip Steps.
Yeah, I don't know Philip Steppard. I don't really know 100% what the screenplay is about. I think that maybe when the Jon Favreau chef movie came out, Philip was very disheartened because the market had been saturated by these stories at that point. But
really, really special agent Philip going undercover as Malcolm is a pretty cool move.
He is I feel kind of bad for him. He did great this week in terms of this show is interesting because a lot of times people get in a rut or they get rattled by feedback that they're given and they overcorrect, and the overcorrecting is seen and it becomes quite a problem. In this particular instance, it feels like Philip corrected himself a little bit, checked his food and checked his ego at the door and produced perfectly good food that's not going to get him sent home. Didn't make any mistakes. He was upset that he wasn't on the top at any point, but he wasn't cooking something that was way out there that was putting him on the bottom. So I'm hopeful, and I mean, I may be in the minority. It sounds like I am. I'm hopeful that Philip can get it together a little bit and really show the best of Philip, because I'm not sure that he's done that on this show yet.
It's so interesting to me this episode, because I feel like Philip says in a confessional, like, I'm just going to focus on cooking technically the best meal that I can. And I feel like that's usually, with any other chef, it would be a strategy to play the middle, which, you know, the judges have said in the past is not a thing to do. And they've actually eliminated people for trying to play the middle and just trying to cook nothing specifically remarkable, just something that's passable to get you through to the next round. But
right.
I think Philip, he's able to get by here because it's sort of a redemption story here. I don't know. I mean, he's on my team, so I have to kind of pull for him, but at the same time, I feel like he's one of those big characters that kind of goes like in these middle rounds that tends to happen a few times in Top Chef history. So I don't know, I have a hankering that he's going to be going in the next few episodes.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was a really interesting exchange at the beginning, kind of the pre-roll to the credits, where it's immediately, you know, post-elimination, and they're chatting, and, you know, it seems like they're having an open and frank discussion about really what went down with Jason's calling out of Philip. And, you know, I think it was, he says, you know, what you consider gummy, I might consider good. And does that make me wrong? And it seemed like the entire
everyone said yes.
Yes, yes, it does. He was like, well, I guess I'm just misunderstood.
I have a random question. Do we think that Kwame is Philip's best friend? Because it seems like Philip doesn't really talk to anybody anymore except for Kwame.
Kwame is everybody's best friend in the house, which
is like a good guy.
Yeah, I'm not saying that in a bad way. I think like he literally is. I think he was like Wes's buddy. He's President Kwame. He's a good guy.
Kwame's social game is on point.
Exactly.
He really was kind of running the show. He was basically saying, like, we have to stop talking about this because we're just going to talk in circles. And he ended the debate about what the issue with Philip was. And he really cut off the talk in a way that didn't upset Philip, because Philip was still on his side and helped him out during the quickfire. But in a way that did get the job done, which is stop people from complaining about this. I did think it was funny that I think it was Isaac, somebody in the background, they were saying, you know, there was so much drama. That was rough. And someone's like, I thought it was hilarious. So I thought that was really funny at the beginning there. Karen also had some shade, threw some shade at Giselle with kind of a Fabio ripoff when she said this isn't top line cook. I thought that was a low blow by Karen.
Yeah, I think we had a discussion last week about, you know, if somebody is called a cook instead of a chef, is that kind of a pejorative term and really kind of meant to be a bigger dig? And yeah, and she called her both was a line cook and a sous chef, and kind of said she didn't really belong there. But I think there's enough screening here that you knew that, you know, Giselle had the chops. It's just that she, you know, wasn't able to come through in a couple of clutches and just unfortunately got eliminated. But yeah, little bit of a cut there.
Yeah, I thought that was a little bit of a cut, and I'm, you know, they get people to say kind of what they need for the TV show to go on the air, but it's hard because Giselle's not around to defend herself, and that's kind of the last thing we hear about her is a dig, so that's rough. What I thought was funny, moving on from that beginning of the show, was Chad's story. Chad talks about how after 9/11 he joins the Navy, and I don't know if this played this way to anybody else, but Chad says, I wanted to go out and kick whoever's ass that did what they did to us. And so the Navy brought me to San Diego.
Also, I mean, my geography might be incorrect, but I feel like the Middle East is not really a place for the Navy to go. So for Chad to be like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, kill everyone who's caused this event. Let me get on a boat and go into the middle of the ocean. That's going to solve all the problems.
Yeah, there is a Persian Gulf you may have heard about, Mike. So there is there is an area over there where we would station battleships to, you know, launch planes off of. But I'm not sure that we really needed Chad in service over there. Although I am
banging
curious.
On Chad. He's all that I have.
I'm curious. Do you think he learned? Because we heard from Chef Amar on this kind of episode about where he really sort of started cooking, about how at 7 years old, he's going across the street, cutting meat, really helping out. And that's getting him in the game. But we hear from Chad, I was in the Navy. And did he learn to cook in the Navy? I mean, is that something, what is he doing? Peeling potatoes? Like, is that, are we creating chefs in the Navy? Is that what we're doing now?
Yeah, that's anyone? What we're training.
Peeler? Yeah. You guys, all three of you are veterans of military service. Isn't that right?
That's not true. That's false.
If I was a veteran of military service and I didn't know where the Persian Gulf was, I feel like that's very indicative of our military.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, that is probably a pretty strong indictment, but I'm not sure, you know, like that may be what's going on. I don't know. I just think it's interesting. I didn't, if you told me one of these chef testants is former military, I would have been, not, Chad would not have been my first.
Chad wouldn't have been. I don't know. He's kind of got like that that like Marine Navy SEAL beard look. Like I feel like I could see that guy as like as played by Chris Pratt in Zero Dark 30 or something like that.
Yeah, like a Zero Dark Chad. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Chad is also a country that has probably had some military issues, so it's entirely possible that you know, I think that the whole Darfur kind of thing, maybe, you know, Chad is like, Chad, that's it, that's what I'll do. I just think it's funny. I laugh because he said, and then they sent me to San Diego. Yeah. So Chad is there. He's in what Jessica Lee on our Amazing Race podcast that Rob has a website here would call a five-hole challenge on The Amazing Race. This is a challenge where it's right in his wheelhouse, something where, you know, you're asked to shoot a hockey puck into a goal and you can't get it through the goalie's legs. This is ultimately Chad is cooking fish tacos in San Diego,
wow,
12 blocks from his restaurant. Did any of you guys think that this was going to go poorly for Chad?
Yeah, I thought so, given the way that it looks like it's been going for me already. that would have just been the nuclear outcome. But you could see it going either way, right? Like, this is either a hero or zero moment. You know, they're not putting this on the show of, oh, I'm home, I'm in San Diego, I'm so close to my restaurant, I know this guy, I know exactly what his palate is like because we've made out before, and I know exactly what he wants. And either he's going to deliver very big, or he is going to be one of the worst items on the board. So I definitely could have seen the outcome where it would have been unfavorable, and not just because my team has been sucking so bad. But thankfully it worked out for my sake and certainly for his. This is, you know, I'm sure, big moment of redemption for the guy.
I like that phrase, you know, zero or hero, and it seems like Top Chef does that a lot, where it builds up a lot of editing storytelling arcs within an episode. And so I think you're exactly right. When we got all that background on Chad, I was expecting, you know, he's either going to completely flub this, or he's going to be, you know, come out on top. And lo and behold, he was the winner.
Yeah, I think it's easy to forget that all these people that are on the season are incredibly talented chefs. Even the ones we look at that aren't really performing in the constraints of the show, don't do well with the format, or make some mistakes, or are rattled, or whatever. These are all really, really talented chefs. And I think that it shows with someone like Chad, who's been pretty anonymous throughout the course of the season, gets a chance to do something he's really good at, steps up and shines. And I think it was a really rewarding challenge for him. And I was glad to see Chef Javier Plasencia there, somebody who Chad knew. I really like that, you know, the kind of tour of California is getting us chefs really from all parts of the state, and people that are doing different things throughout the state. So I thought that was really cool. We've got the quick fire here. Chad is on the top, as we talked about. He makes kind of a shark taco, and he really amps the heat up. We also have Kwame on top with a Wahoo taco, does something really good with the tortilla. And Karen is on the top for her Asian blend. And I think this is the beginning, obviously, of a really good episode for Karen. Did anything else stand out to you guys from the quick fire? Because Angelina doesn't get her tacos on the plate. She's on the bottom. They don't really talk about anybody else from the quick fire as a result of this. So I'm curious, Kurt, is there anything that jumped out to you about the quick fire specifically, other than the people that were on the top or Angelina not getting her tacos on the plate?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm not the biggest fish taco fan. I mean, I am a big fan of truffle oil, so there are several things there that intrigued me. I do have some commentary on the Angelina thing, but I can bookmark that until we get to discussing.
Was Big Dougie like the guy who had like a mango wrapper?
Yeah,
for his
had Angelina plated her taco in time, and depending on, you know, how it tasted, I feel like Wesley would have finished in last, because considering the components of his taco almost fell apart immediately upon them picking it up, because he chose to put it in a mango slice, I guess it was. It was a pretty poor choice. I mean, a couple of other ones that got sort of negative feedback was our boy Isaac, who, you know, went for this like family story about this more of this like taco salad, I think, that they would catch fish in the lake and do it. But I think they said it was a little too greasy.
Yeah.
And Marjorie, who actually does not have the best episode, despite, you know, doing pretty well the previous set of episodes, she produces this taco and they say they wish it was a little more spicy. So I wonder, had Angelina plated her taco on time, maybe those three would have wound up in the bottom.
According to Angelina, yes. Yes, she would have won.
I mean, it's always going to play out that way where the person says that. But yeah, I do agree that that she didn't seem to make any really negative choices in terms of what she was doing. And Wesley not using a tortilla and using a mango wrapper that made the thing hard to eat, and really just kind of Wesleying it up. I feel like that definitely would have put him on the bottom three at least. But I mean, it's really the same result, I think, because it's a sudden death quick fire. We have Angelina at the bottom. She picks Wesley to cook against. And I think Wesley probably would have chosen her. So it ends up really how it ends up. Kurt, do you have any other thoughts on the subject before we move on to how the sudden death played out?
It's just, going back to Wesley, I always thought we kind of glossed over Lobster Gate, where he kind of completely freaked out for placing his lobster in the wrong workstation. So, but good for Wesley. He apologized to everybody for his freak out. But one of my friends on Twitter at Bryce CR tweeted out, "What are the plating rules? Why can Philip use rocks, but what's her face can't use a cutting board?" So it's like.
It's a fair point. I think that Bryce saying that, I mean, I think that's a really fair point, because, I don't know how that kind of played out. I mean, the tacos are right there, and I'm thinking that they weren't 100% sure whether or not, whether or not that should play out the way it played out. I think she was at least hoping that she could still get her tacos tasted, but they didn't taste them. So it was really rough, I think, ultimately for Angelina to see that play out the way it played out.
So I don't know if you can hear that siren in the background. This is pretty rough. We just lost Josh. Josh texted me and said, "I'm alive, but we have a fire department situation on our hands. Go on without me. Sorry for the immediate evacuation." So hopefully Josh is okay and his house isn't burning down. I don't think that that's the case. There's probably an alarm going off in his building. But Josh is out of the podcast for now. I think it was the talk about Angelina that brought him out, guys. I really do. I don't believe this fire department story.
So he pulled a Beverly in that he just came back from Last Chance Kitchen and then was eliminated like the next round.
It sure seems like it. He had some good takes, too. This is too bad. But hopefully Josh doesn't burn down in a fire.
Yeah, I wonder if this is the same issue that was facing Kelly Wentworth at the end of her interview with Rob. I believe that she also had to leave because there was a fire department issue or a fire alarm issue.
Are we starting to get into like series of unfortunate events territory here, guys, where there's a coalition of people that are starting fires of various podcasters?
Oh my gosh. Like, is somebody coming after Rob has a website or reality wrap ups? Is there an enemy out there?
Has anyone heard from the Pod on Pod guys recently?
It's entirely possible. Maybe it's just somebody who wants to work in the same zone. Like maybe somebody trying to start their own Patreon group or trying to start their own podcast in Rob's world. Maybe they're coming at Rob hardcore. Maybe we're going to have podcast wars, guys.
Oh boy, is that anything like restaurant wars?
There's got to be something in the Star Wars universe called Pod Wars, by the way. But yeah, no, I don't know. I don't know what's happening. Hopefully we'll get an update from Josh before the end of the show. And we'll be able to let everybody know that Josh is okay. We press on like we do. This what Josh would want. He said he wants the show to go on. So here we go. We were talking basically about the quick fire. We really kind of covered the ups and downs. We get into this sudden death quick fire. And guys, I don't know, did this week's sudden death quickfire, did that kind of hammer home for you guys what we talked about strategy-wise? Like, maybe Angelina should take Marjorie here, and Marjorie would be inclined to maybe not give it her best because she wanted Angelina to stay in?
I was wondering if that was going to be a possibility. I seriously did, because like Marjorie does, like I said, she seems to view Angelina as like a little sister role. But what do you think, Mike?
I mean, I don't know. If I was in that situation and I got picked, I feel like you cannot reward somebody who did not plate their food. I mean, this is probably the latest in the competition where someone did not plate their food entirely. In fact, I don't even know. I'm sure there are a couple situations of people not plating certain components of their food, but... You know, we even saw this with, I think it was with Karen a few weeks ago when she didn't give Padma the fish. But I can't remember many situations where someone didn't get their entire dish onto the plate. And so I feel like that's a big enough of a mark on her that I wouldn't want to throw it to her.
See, I would have come at from the opposite direction in terms of, like, it seemed like she put together a really great dish. And it's just unfortunate that she wasn't even able to serve it because of the small issue at the end of just, you know, not getting it on the plate in time. And I almost would have been more likely to say, you know what, that's just really unfortunate. It doesn't really reflect the cooking as much as the presenting at the end. And I think I would have been more likely to throw it to her than less likely. But if I had been someone like, say, Marjorie, but it seems like she's not making a lot of friends in that kitchen. It goes back to that social game and the strategy that Antonia brought up. So it's there's no way Wesley was going to even like try to throw it to her. But yeah, maybe pick Marjorie. Maybe she'll have a little bit of compassion for her. But if it'd been me up there, definitely wouldn't have thrown it.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I think you're right. I think if it's me up there, I'm not throwing it. But I mean, we heard what Wesley said. Like, Wesley's like, I have to cook well here. Like, I have to do my best. And I think other people would have been similarly motivated. But Wesley really has been called out, not because Angelina thinks that he'll kind of roll over for her, but because she thinks she can beat him. And I think that's probably the roughest part of it, is that he really has to step up and say, you cannot beat me. Like, I will send you home. I'm sorry, but it is what it is. And I think, depending on the chef, you might have a different result if they felt differently about what they wanted to do in the quickfire. I mean, ultimately, it really wasn't. I mean, she didn't get her tacos on the plate, but as we're talking about Bryce's comment earlier, she doesn't get them on the plate. Like, they're right there. What's the difference between the rock and the and saying, oh, I've played it on the cutting board? So yeah,
that's what AJ Mass actually asked me on Twitter, is, you know, if Angelina could have just gotten away by being like, no, this is a cutting board plate, and this it's really earthy and authentic and speaks literally farm to table.
Yeah, yeah, she should
try it. Just try it, at least. Try to sell it. It seemed like that's the thing that I think that disappointed me most, is she didn't try to sell it in any way that we saw. I would at least would have tried to, like, make it work, as they say.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you at least try to make it work and do something and kind of chef it up a little bit. But, you know, she didn't, and it's tough because we get into this quick fire, the sudden death quick fire kind of cook-off. Which I think is very interesting. Take the ingredients of a Caesar salad. The Caesar salad is prevalent because of the guest judge, Chef Javier, works at the restaurant Caesar, where the Caesar salad was invented. It's his restaurant, essentially, at this point. So they have to take the ingredients in a classic Caesar salad and do whatever they want with them. Make some kind of dish. Of course, they only have 15 to 20 minutes to get it all together, but they get it together. Angelina really plays it safe and goes with the crostini. So she's just taking kind of the bread from the Caesar salad crouton and putting the rest of the ingredients from the Caesar salad on top of it in just kind of a bite-sized form. Fair enough. Fair play. It is what it is. Wesley does a little bit different. He makes a nice kind of what he calls a composed egg dish, where he cooks an egg very nicely and he puts the rest of the ingredients kind of from the Caesar salad on top of the egg. Both the comments from Chef Javier were, both of them probably could have used a little more sauce or condiment element. In Wesley's case, he wanted more garlic sauce, and in Angelina's, he wanted more sauce on top of the crostini. We don't really hear negative comments other than that, but Wesley does win. We don't really hear if that's because his dish was more composed or more put together or more creative, but it certainly seemed to me like the elegance of his dish ultimately did win the day for him. Any eulogy for Angelina, Mike? Are you sad to see Angelina go?
I mean, I think Angelina was, I wouldn't call her one of the major characters of the first six episodes as much as I call her one of the major players, and that was partly in fault because I believe she finished either on the bottom or the top in the first four episodes, and last episode was the only time she was in the middle, but still, she was involved in some conflict there where Jason had immunity but was basically trying to hold her hand and telling her how to make that specific dish last episode. So, I mean, I think her age had a lot to play into her general character this season. I mean, it's interesting that this was sort of the battle between the oldest and the youngest contestants that were on the show, and I think she had a lot to prove, but that being said, Angelina also seems like the type of person that, and maybe some stuff happened off camera that we don't know about, but she probably felt like she was an underdog going in and almost overcompensated because of that. And so that's why we saw several times over the course of her time on Top Chef, you're overcomplicating things, you're doing too much on the plate, just keep it simple, which she tried to do in this challenge, but it was compared to Wesley, who made this overall a better dish, overall just a more highly regarded and more impressive dish. So when she should have overcomplicated things, she did it, and I feel like that's kind of her Achilles heel.
Yeah, and I, when I was looking at the two dishes, I was thinking that Wesley probably had this one in the bag, only because my impression was that the judges were looking for, like, you know, you start out with the basic ingredients of a pretty famous salad. What's the furthest away from a Caesar salad you can get? And it seemed to me like Angelina had made kind of more of a salad type entity on a crostini, whereas Wesley had really just kind of bumped up the egg element and had made more of an egg dish. I think maybe that's one of the things that got him the win, is that he thought outside the box a little bit more than her in terms of what you could possibly do with these ingredients.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that this is this was a little bit more creative from Wesley, and I think thinking of egg dish is good. Obviously, there are some chefs. Wiley Dufresne really is the main one that comes to mind that people know love eggs. There are probably some chefs that don't like eggs as much. So it's a big risk, I think, probably. So that's what's going on there, maybe.
That's you just brought up a good point, because there's, I think I saw it both in last week's episode and I think in this week's episode. I'd have to go, for instance, the use of particular ingredients and maybe a chef's just tendency just to really not like a food. For instance, I am really not a huge fan of fennel. In fact, I cannot stand fennel. And there were several, and there were several times.
Not a fennel of fennel?
Oh gosh. And moving on. There were several times where I was like, you know, seeing the description of the dish and I was like, I completely would not like this, because I mean, I can stand it when it's cooked, but when it's like a more of a raw ingredient in a salad or something, I was like, I just can't. And I'm wondering if there are instances where these judges, like, you know, yeah, even though they're kind of, they're big in the culinary world, there have to be foods and ingredients they just don't like. And I'm thinking, what do you do when you like get that from a judge? Because you know, they have to kind of force themselves to, you know, comment on the texture and the choice of ingredients. But if they could serve something that's just an ingredient or a food that they are just not a fan of, have we ever really seen that?
I don't really think. I think that that's tough. There, I mean, obviously there are some things. I think that we that Tom is notable for really having issues with. Tom doesn't like bitter melon. We talked about that earlier right. In this season. There are some, you know, ingredients where we've seen particular chefs or judges usually say like they have a problem with. But a lot of the times we see that it's in context of them saying, I don't like X, but this worked really well. So in a lot of cases, I think we usually see kind of the other end of that where it works really well. I do think there are some ingredients. Fennel is not one of them. I don't understand your hatred, although there are some people who obviously can't stand cilantro. And that's a palate thing. It's a genetic thing. Cilantro to some people tastes like soap, and there's nothing they can do about it, and there's nothing you can change about it. There's nothing you can dress up and hide. If your palate tastes cilantro as soap, it's going to taste like soap. And so Fabio, the chef Fabio on Top Chef, is one of the notable anti-cilantro people because his palate just tastes it like soap, and that is what it is. So I do think that there are some instances you're going to run up against where that happens. I think the show probably edits a lot of that out. We don't want it to seem, I don't think, like somebody got sent home just because they had the unfortunate circumstance of cooking food for a judge that judge didn't particularly like. I think these judges like to be seen as gourmands who have a taste and a palate for everything. So I do think that that's part of what we see on the show in terms of what is edited for us. You know, we're not going to see somebody being like, I didn't like it. I don't like cilantro in the kind of judge's table feedback, because that's not very instructive on kind of whether or not the dish was well composed, constructed, cooked, etc.
All right. I think there's a chance that Josh Wigler has returned to this podcast. I don't know. Josh, are you here?
Hi.
What happened, Josh? We heard there was a fire. Is there
a
fire?
Yeah. Yeah. There was it wasn't really a fire. There was like the threat of the fire, which is almost as scary. It's like there could be a fire at any moment type of situation that just happened. Yeah. As we were talking, last thing I remember is we were talking about the quick fire challenge and Big Dougie using the mango wrapper for his taco and blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly my computer turned off because I found out that my wonderful wife, Emily, my wife, had turned off the circuit breaker in the apartment because our stove was threatening to explode. So we had the fire department over. We took care of that. And now we're alive and everything's okay and I'm back.
I like how you phrased it as like we had the fire department over, like you broke out some tea.
Yeah,
broke out some beers.
It almost felt like that's what we should have done, because by the time that they had gotten here, the situation had kind of resolved itself. We were like feeling pretty confident that the situation had resolved itself. And then suddenly we just had four firefighters in our kitchen. And I kind of want to be like, you want a beer? The only beer we've got is non-alcoholic, but I'll give it to you. I mean, you're on the job anyway. So... yeah,
New York's bravest coming right in, just kinda, you know, offering them beers. Did you have four different kinds of beer to offer them by any chance?
I think we had two different types of non-alcoholic beer, which we have in the fridge for my bro who does not drink but likes non-alcoholic beer.
He likes the taste of beer.
Yeah, my brother likes the taste of beer, but he doesn't drink alcohol, so he drinks non-alcoholic beer.
Grandma used to be.
Yeah. So that was that. That was my day. How are you guys? How's everything? What did I miss?
Wait, actually, you bring up a good point, and I think this is a perfect segue into the elimination challenge, where the judges hand out these beers for people to drink. Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't Chad a recovering alcoholic, and he drank a beer on the show?
Everybody is after my man, Chad!
I don't think he's ever vocalized that he's a recovering alcoholic. He's just said he doesn't drink.
Yep.
And B, in the tableau of everybody toasting and cheering, he's got his bottle down to the side with the cap still on. So that was an ongoing. I didn't see him drink beer at all during the episode. I know when we saw him do this before, he kind of went on what the description of what was in it, and during the wine pairing challenge with the I believe it was the sea urchin. But here I'm thinking, you know, because he knew what the notes were or what the brewery ingredients were, that he was probably going off of that. But my impression was that A, he didn't drink, and B, that's got to suck because this isn't a quick fire. This is the elimination challenge. But luckily he had immunity, so it's not like it really mattered.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be tough to not be a drinker and to be a cooker, if you will, to be a chef, because this is, we saw the wine pairing issue earlier. Grayson kind of was really bubbling to the top there. We see a beer challenge here, and it's a sneaky beer challenge. It's, hey, let's all raise a glass to our departed, chef testant here. Let's raise a glass to the middle of the season. But no, there are four beers from the Stone Brewing Company in Ballast Point in San Diego. We have a porter, a golden ale, a stout, and I guess a wheat beer is really what it all came down to. I'm not really sure exactly what Emerald's beer was. I think it was some kind of porter because it had coffee and was very dark. But yeah, I don't know. Do you guys know anything about these beers? Does anyone know, are these beers going to be available for sale? I had someone ask me that on Twitter, and I thought maybe somebody might have more information than I do.
Ooh, I don't have info, but I would like that. That sounds,
I mean,
great.
I feel like I would like three of the beers to possibly be sold in stores. I feel like if they sell Richard's beer, it should give directions to pour directly into the toilet. Because I'm sorry, that beer sounds disgusting.
Was that the banana beer? Who had the banana beer?
Banana beer was Tom. Richard's was the Beets chocolate and the Ras Al Hanou, which was the North African spice blend.
Isn't he Oliver Queen's arch enemy?
Yes, he is. Yeah. The head of the League of Assassins, right?
Yeah, Ras Al Hanou.
He had problems with Batman as well.
Wesley and Jeremy had to go into the middle of the Himalayan mountains to train in order to make this dish.
And they picked a blue flower and they put it in, and it was great.
Isn't that always Richard's move, though, for like any of these? I forget the exact specifics of it, but last season on Top Chef Boston, wasn't there this you're going to let the judges shop for you challenge?
Yeah.
And doesn't Richard always just like pick the dumbest stuff? He's just like, let me find a basket full of esoteric ingredients that I'm going to throw your way because I want one of my contestants to be eliminated in this episode.
It really does seem like this is Blaise's MO. He does seem to be really screwing people over with the basket.
I don't think it's like intentional.
Beers.
It doesn't feel like he's intentionally screwing people over. I think that's just the Richard Blaise thing, but there's a reason why Richard Blaise works well with that stuff, because it's uniquely Richard Blaise. His set of tastes, the things that he wants other people to execute because he can execute them, are not executable for most people, I would think. So he really doesn't play to other people's strengths. He only plays to his. And I think that might be a sign of him as a bit of a rookie judge. You know, I don't think that Tom Colicchio is just going to shop for people based on how Tom Colicchio cooks. I think that he is going to come up with something that would be interesting for multiple people to create, whereas Blaise is really just coming up with his Blaise basket every time.
Yeah, and I think it's also very indicative that of him being a rookie judge that he kept going back to this one phrase describing Jason's dish of, this is the strangest thing that's ever been put in front of me ever. And
yeah.
He said that at least like three or four times over the course of 10 minutes. And this is definitely signs of him being a rookie judge of like, okay, I got to find a hook. I got to be like the quippy guy. And so he thinks he found this big catchphrase, and you keep running it into the ground, man. And then when he's describing like, okay, beets are sweet, I guess, and the Ras Al Hanou is spicy, and they're like, why the chocolate? He goes like, oh, just the sense of mystery. I'm like, what? That's just such a douchey thing to say, Richard. You shouldn't throw an ingredient in there for them just because it's mysterious.
A little Richard Blaise goes a long way for me, and a lot of Richard Blaise is just, it's too much. I did like what he said about the aliens, though. I thought it was funny.
Go ahead, Kurt.
Say, I did a quick search online. There is a Stone Brewing Company Top Chef Golden Ale, which sounds a little bit like it might be Padma's. So maybe like one or two of the beers might actually be out there if you can search for it. But there is a Stone Top Chef Golden Ale.
Yeah, and I was going to say to Daniel Powell, the person who asked about this on Twitter, there is also a pretty good article that I'd found from what I think is West Coaster, which looks like a West Coast kind of beer website, about kind of behind the scenes of the beer episode here. And so there is a possible spoiler. I don't really think it's a spoiler. It talks about some of the things that have happened since the recording of this episode that people are speculating about. But anyway, we'll link that in the show notes for this particular podcast, a kind of a behind the scenes of how the beers were developed and what the decisions that were made about the beers were from somebody who worked at the Stone Brewing Company at Ballast Point when the beers were kind of conceived. So we're going to definitely link that. But yeah, these are interesting. I mean, we did kind of cover that, that there were four different ones. There's a golden ale. Padma has jalapeno, ginger, and tamarind. There's a stout from Richard with chocolate and Ra's al Ghul and beets. There is the wheat beer from Tom with lemon, coriander, and banana. And then there is from Emerald, the New Orleans style beer with coffee, cayenne, and tangerine. Guys, there's four of us. Who is which beer?
Oh, here we go.
Oh, boy.
And you go ahead, call me the stout. That's fine. I don't care.
No. But I want to be the stout.
Well, you can be the porter.
I think you and I are in. Oh, I'll be the porter.
Yeah, you'll be the porter. So we're between Mike. Which one of Kurt and Mike is the golden ale with jalapeno, ginger, and tamarind?
Who's blonder?
Who's blonder?
I've dyed my hair blonde once.
All right, that's
Kurt, so, is this your Eminem phase?
Yeah. It was when I lived in L.A.
Antonio, I don't want to see you throwing any stones here. I'm your Facebook friend.
I didn't.
I've
single
looked
stone.
Into your past a little bit.
No stone is thrown.
Is
not a stone thrown.
I probably would have liked Emerald's beer the best, but I do tend to say having a kind of a jalapeno flavor to things that aren't particularly necessarily seen as a little bit of a spice or a kick do tend to draw me in. So I'll be Padma's golden ale.
So what is that? Am I the wheat then?
Yeah, you're lemon and coriander with a little bananas inside. I think that that's
well. Good. I do have a little banana, so I think it all.
full bloom.
Mark that time code. We're going to edit
full
that
bloom.
Out.
Yep. Full bloom. No, leave it.
It's especially bad in light of what Chef Isaac's plan for the banana is.
Oh my god, I love. I feel like it was a random draw, right? But I feel like there were certain picks that were just too good to be true, like Wesley picking Richard's beer, considering that you served Richard's restaurant. And Isaac picking the banana, which he is livid about. He says, I would give money for anyone else's beer. And as Antonio alludes to, he's sitting in the car thinking like, okay, maybe I'll freeze the banana in liquid nitrogen and then shove it up my ass.
Yeah, that's tough. It's tough. It's tough play for Chef Isaac here. Not good. Not great. Not something that he's fond of. Although it's funny because we'll get into the top and the bottom of this challenge and who makes it where, but it's not as though the banana is an automatic loss for people. It just seemed to get it in Chef Isaac's head. So maybe banana is just not something he really uses a lot, and it's not something he can come up with a solid plan for, and he just gets rattled. I'm interested. We got a little more backstory here about Chef Jason. He really talked about how he'd kind of left his executive positions before Top Chef, and he's sort of in the wind now, and he's going on Top Chef to get recharged. We've seen in past seasons people kind of finding their voice on Top Chef, somebody starting out, for example, as a shadow chef and really finding their own cuisine, or other people who by the end of the season have really hit their stride. Is Top Chef a place to find yourself like that? Do you think that we're getting kind of the beginning of the redemption story for Jason? It doesn't go well for him this episode. So in the moment, I thought maybe when I thought of that scene, like this is his kind of elimination scene that we're getting in this episode. Doesn't work out that way. But I'm wondering if you guys think the arrow is pointing up or down on Chef Jason.
The arrow is pointing at Ra's al Ghul.
Yes. And he has failed the city. But what about Chef Jason? Where does he fit in? Kurt, you have something to say here?
Yeah, I think I know it's almost like the opposite situation, I think, again, that we found ourselves with Grayson before, where, she suddenly, after a couple down episodes, did a really great job. It was like, is this the start of her redemption story? Is she going to be climbing the upward path? And we really saw it was just kind of like a one and done for that episode that she had done great. I think that it might just be the same thing for Jason here, where it was to Josh's comment earlier, a kind of a hero or zero edit. This was him being a zero. He was in the bottom. He did survive, but I don't think that this necessarily indicates that he's going to continually then get in some sort of downward spiral through the next few episodes. I think that, it's almost like a clean slate for him at the start of the next episode. So I'm not too worried about Jason.
This may be a blanket term, but I'm going to throw this out to you guys. Do you find Jason a little snobby? Because now I'm starting to see with this whole like historian thing and him trying to bring out this idea of pork and squid meatballs, and also his sort of treatment of Philip the past couple of episodes, and his whole idea of the first big scene we saw of him was him feeling kind of rejected by the whole bro alliance that was going on. Now I'm starting to see that maybe it's because Jason, you know, he composes himself and he views himself in a different way, and that might come off as a little high and mighty in somebody else's eyes.
Yeah, the edit makes it seem like, I mean, Carl observes this, that Jason is sort of cooking these forgotten dishes. And this becomes sort of a point of contention in this episode. And Padma throws a really snarky line about maybe they should stay forgotten. But it is interesting. You can't get on a show like this and try to educate Tom Colicchio and Padma and Emeril and Richard Blaise about the history of Catalan cuisine and how soft and soft should eat differently and be better. And it's their, you know, the dish is right, but they're looking at it wrong. And it's really interesting to look at this in the context of Jason being the one coming at Philip. When Philip's argument is, I'm cooking the food that I want, is it my fault that the judges don't like it? Like, I'm cooking, you know, I wanted that those mashed potatoes to be exactly how they were. They said it was gummy. Fine. Like, that's my food. That's what I want to do. And that's exactly what Jason did in this episode. Jason did say he didn't feel like the dish was representative of something good from him. But on the other hand, I feel like conceptually it's what he wanted. So he is trying to do conceptual things that other people aren't feeling. And he's an outlier on. And that's the same kind of thing that Philip's getting criticized for. So I do think it's a little interesting. That's all.
Yeah, I haven't gotten necessarily a snobby vibe from him in previous episodes. I mean, I think there's a very particular vibe from him. If you go back to the, it's not the dolma cabbage roll from last week.
Not the dolma at all.
Yes, it like he has a very specific, you know, conception. But it wasn't so much for me snobby as it was particular. Like, this is the first time I think we've seen him, from my recollection, characterized as, you know, like a chef archaeologist where he's trying to unearth these forgotten foods and educate the public. So we'll see, one point is a piece of data. You need at least 3 points to form a trend. So let's see if this happens again in the next episode or two.
I have this image now of Jason as the Top Chef Alan Grant, of being this paleontologist that's trying.
Dr. Grant!
Exactly.
Yeah. I think that he would really scare the crap out of that raptor kid.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it is a almost indefensible position if you're trying to educate these people on what, you know, the history of Catalan cuisine is, to not come off a little bit like you are, or feel like maybe know more than somebody, or that to come off like a snob. That's a very tough position to operate from and come off as humble or as sort of the sorts of things that Chef Jason may well be, but that are the opposite of how it's being interpreted. So it is very interesting. I mean, Richard said about Chef Jason's meal, like it was almost like a alien had abducted him and captain. And he asked the alien, like, what do you eat? And then tried to recapture the cuisine, which, of course, is interesting from Richard, because everything Richard does seems to try to be whimsical and be interesting. And, you know, I'm quoting Chef Wesley there, of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, just try to do that. So I don't know. Having an unusual dish put in front of you, I'm surprised that of all the people, Richard Blaise was the most upset about it. But this is, I think, a really interesting subject matter that's kind of in play here. And we're seeing an interesting side of Chef Jason that, you're right, Kurt, is only one data point, but it's not the first data point we have on Chef Jason. And so Mike is trying, I think, to read all those points in the same sort of kind of linked, you know, connection. And you're saying that this is the first time he's really come off like a paleontologist. So
for me,
I guess
for
we'll
me.
Just see how this develops. For me, too. So,
but it's
we'll
interesting
how it develops.
Like, I don't think of squid meatball as a classic dish. That's the other thing that kind of threw me a little bit upon reflection, in terms of it seemed like definitely a strange dish. But and again, this is just, I'm not a culinary historian by any means, but because you did have several people, several of the judges talking about reviving these classic dishes. Squid meatball would not have been at the top of my list of, oh, that is a classic.
Vintage squid meatball action. I'm all about it. Yeah, I used to eat it all the time.
I remember coming home from school, second grade. My mom had a big plate of pork and squid meatballs. We just dig in, watch some Cartoon Network, and then that was my day.
Yeah, I'm with you, man.
That explains so much.
Listen, some kids had Pop-Tarts. Some kids had Hot Pockets. We had squid meatball.
I stand corrected. I stand corrected.
Yeah.
I'm with you, Kurt. I guess us Midwest kind of, you know, Rust Belt types, or we had a little different experience.
Yeah, it's an East Coast thing.
I mean, as you know, squid is so prevalent on the East Coast that it really is a delicacy.
There's water right there somewhere.
Really, just beyond the squid meatballs, we're all about soft on soft. It's just like that's all.
That's the motto of the East Coast.
Yeah, soft on soft.
I mean, I had mac and squid all the time. Don't get me wrong, but not the squid meatballs.
Oh, okay. All right. I didn't have squid at all, and I'm Italian. I didn't even have calamari, so who knows? But that is interesting, talking about like what you ate when you grew up. I don't think that Jason ate historic Catalan cuisine as he was growing up. I think this is something he's become passionate about. And I do think we had him talk about earlier in the season, a kind of an ancient recipe. I feel like it might have been one of his first recipes when he was in that first kind of elimination challenge. He resurrected some kind of, it wasn't Catalan. I don't remember what it was, but he did resurrect some kind of dish. That one went really well. So I do think it's interesting that he seems to want to cook a cuisine and kind of be out there in that regard. And it's sort of fascinating. And I think it was Top Chef Seattle. We had a challenge at a very famous restaurant where they recreated the menu from 1950. And in that instance, that menu and those dishes, they had to really capture what it was like. And it was sort of like palates were different. People's expectations were different. If you're making like a certain kind of salad, for example, you can't really dress it up and make it too modern without losing the essence of what it was. And so for some of these dishes, Jason's got to be, I think, a little more careful about who he's putting the dish in front of and what challenge it's part of, because certainly this seems to be his kind of thing, but it's definitely getting him in trouble. And it's interesting because we talk about what people were like when they were young. This is where Amr talks about what he's been cooking since he was 7. And he says that this elimination challenge is the first time he's been able to showcase his style of cooking. I personally found that interesting. I don't know what you guys think. Doesn't it seem like, especially that first elimination challenge where Amr cooked the meatball with the cream cheese and the everything bagel spice, that was an opportunity to showcase his food? They weren't given any real constraints there, right?
Yeah, Amar's interesting. He's gone a little purple. He's gone a mauve the past few weeks because, I mean,
not allow that. Go ahead.
he was our veritable like number one pick, or at least he was my number one pick after Josh picked Francis. Because he had finished like in the top and gotten very high compliments throughout the first two episodes, but he went very quiet thereafter. And it's not like he was, you know, cooking bad food. He never ended up in the bottom, but it seemed like he was sort of riding that middle, or maybe he was so spooked by the circumstances of each challenge that he really decided to not really take any big risks. And I agree, because I mean, he was able to cook within constraints in the first couple challenges and it was fine. Here, I feel like there are even more constraints of these are three ingredients that you have to highlight. And he says, oh yeah, I can do this now. Maybe it's because he said he's doing a version of a jalapeno popper. So maybe it's an idea of like, I'm going to tie this back to something that I am associated with. And that's part of my style as opposed to what I've been cooking the past few weeks. But I agree with you, Antonio. That statement did come a little out of nowhere for me.
Well, I just think it's interesting because I if there was a Top Chef drinking game, I think one of the things on the Top Chef drinking game would be, well, let's create one, or let's help curate the one that exists already. But I think one kind of take a shot is anytime a chef talks about my food, like I want to cook my food, or this isn't really representative of my food. And we hear that a lot from these chefs. I thought that this was interesting because you're right, Mike. There were specific constraints in this challenge, unlike the first elimination challenge, where the only constraint really was you're going to have to cook for a lot of people in a pretty short period of time. So I don't know why this is the time that Chef Amar felt particularly inspired to do what he's been doing. But I think that it's interesting because, of course, he does really well. But it's like, does he need to have the inspiration provided by the challenge to, you know, that it sings to some particular part of him that he's already familiar with? I think the true skill of a top chef is when they throw the challenge at you, you're inspired by what's there, and you can turn what's there into something great. It's not that it resonates with something that you already know how to do and do well. So looking forward for Chef Amar, I think he really has to step his game up and not just be inspired when he's given a few ingredients that sound to him like things he's familiar with using. He needs to be able to do what Chef Isaac doesn't do in this episode, which is take the ingredients and be inspired by them to create something new. So I think that that's interesting. speaking of Chef Isaac, he says he asked a question, at least I've asked myself before, I'll admit, and I don't know about you guys. He says, am I high or is this good? He's talking about his bananas. Would you guys buy bananas? Would you try bananas, or it just sounds too gross?
No, I'm out on bananas. First off, mayonnaise is outlawed in my house because my wife is allergic to eggs, and no mayonnaise eggs. Is primarily egg-based, so that's already out. I'm not a banana guy. I'm not a banana man. I've never been. I never will be. So bananas just sounds like the trash to me.
See, Josh, if you get bananas sent to you, send it right over to me because I'm a big banana guy, and I'm an unintentional mayonnaise guy. My wife will make sandwiches. And
you're a big banana guy? That's not what you'd said earlier.
Well, I that's what, you know, it's you know, you visualize it in your head and you try to actualize yourself, quote Peggy from Fargo. So I guess maybe that's a dream that I'm working towards. But I enjoy bananas and mayonnaise, and I figure if you combine them both together, it's got to be something interesting, right? And this component of Isaac's dish was the good part, they said. I think where he stumbled was when he tried to make a salad and soup together.
Yeah. I kind of want to delve more into Mike's phrase, unintentional mayonnaise guy.
But Me too. That was on my radar as well.
let's table that. I think I am, though, in Mike's camp a little bit here. And just in terms of, I will try any food once. And I am a fan of strange combinations of flavors. So I would try the bananas. I think because it is kind of a condiment, I'm wondering, like, but what would it be served to me on? Because I could see it, like, I just don't know what it would go well with. That would be a huge determining factor, I think, in terms of how much I enjoyed it.
Like, what would it go? What does it naturally go with? What sort of savory dish does bananas go with? I mean, is it a dessert mayonnaise? You know, that seems strange to me.
That's what I was wondering too.
You know, if it was plantain maize, you know, that might be interesting. You could like do some sort of cool Cuban cuisine with that. That might work. But bananas just seems strange to me.
Well, I mean, I feel like if you made like the Elvis, I feel like that could go perfectly with it.
There you go.
That's actually a terrific point. Great point.
So peanut butter on one slice of bread, bananas on the other, and maybe some bananas and bacon in the middle.
Yeah, just monstrous amounts of bacon in the middle. I could eat that. I would mess with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. The bananas did not go poorly with the judges. They liked the crab salad with the bananas, and they thought that, I think the comment that Isaac got actually from Padma was, just give us the crab salad and the bananas and it's a home run. Put that on some kind of other dish and you're good to go. That it was the velouté and everything that he made, the kind of soup that he made that was too thick, that was really a problem, and that the dish got mixed up because of that. So the bananas was actually very good. So we can talk a lot of junk about bananas, but sounds like the answer to Isaac's question is, like, it is good. Bananas does work. So,
which doesn't, you know, necessarily mean he wasn't high as well.
No, that's true.
Those aren't two mutually exclusive states.
Yeah, very true. Did you also, like, I feel like the Top Chef editors were in prime form this episode where, you know, hashtag bananas came up, but every time, I don't know if you noticed, but every time Isaac mentioned it, it would pop up in the corner very briefly.
Yeah,
just almost like a Fight Club, like, superimposed film strip onto it.
Yeah.
They're just editing a quick banana into the episode.
he got a hashtag out of it. He got the episode title out of it. He got a huge pop from the judges when he mentioned the word bananas. Tom laughed really hard, and then they liked it. So I feel like, even though my boy Chef Isaac Toops was in the bottom on this challenge, I feel like it was a good episode for Isaac. So I feel like that's what you need to do. If you're going to be on the bottom and still come away looking like roses, smelling like roses, tasting like roses, however you want to say it, I think that it works out really well. Other people struggled with certain beers. Padma's dressed like a Kardashian. This is what's going on in the challenge. Amar and Chad were Team Padma. They both did really well. We talked about that. Team Richard was Wesley, Karen, and Jeremy. We talked a little bit about this. I don't know. Anybody have any particular thoughts on what happened with Wesley? He just didn't cook his lamb correctly, it sounded like. He got kind of lost in the kitchen, like he has been throughout the season.
Wesley kind of had a bad episode here between, you know, he got picked for the bottom he was probably in the bottom for the quick fire, had Angelina plated. He got picked for the sudden death and won. Then he got eliminated. And on top of that, they showed his big butt crack on TV. So I didn't see that. Yeah.
Oh, didn't see that?
There were a couple times when and especially in the coming up on, they had a big shot of Wesley's butt crack as he was bent over.
It had its own gravitational pull. Yeah, there was a lot of crack there going on. That was a lot that was happening. He was auditioning for Top Plumber, not Top
Shelf. Top Shelf Plumber. I was surprised to see Wesley go. I was very surprised that they picked Big Doug to go home over Jason. I really thought that it was going to be Jason with his squid meatballs. And I didn't really weigh in on Jason too much, but I did have a hot take on Jason very quickly, just to bring it up, is I think that this guy has no shot at winning. I think what he's putting down, these people are not picking up. And I think that the goal in Top Chef, in order to win, you really got to be the best version of yourself. And I don't think that there's any version of himself, even his best version of himself, that seems like something these guys want to put in their mouths. So I think that he's in trouble. And I was really shocked that Big Dougie went home over Jason. I really thought that this was Jason's night.
I agree, especially because it from the very beginning it seemed like Wesley was very much telegraphing that he was in trouble, and I thought it was, and again, I try not to pay too much attention to the editing in terms of pointing me in a particular direction, but between him commenting that, you know, I have Richard's beer, he's very whimsical, I'm very straightforward, this was designed for me to fail, oh, I overcooked my lamb, there's no way that I don't go home for this, it was almost like too much indication in the editing that Wesley was in trouble. I didn't believe he was actually going to go home. It would seem too telegraphic for me, but no, it was a pretty straightforward episode, like in terms of what we were told, in terms of what was wrong with his cooking.
Well, see, I disagree, actually. I kind of saw him going home just because, again, it's this fundamental conflict that we always come into with Top Chef of, here's Wesley, a guy who did not cook his food well, versus Jason, a guy who did not create a good dish, conceptually. And that's sort of the question that they always sort of weigh here of, you know, bad cooking versus bad chef skills. And this time, again, it fell onto bad cooking where, you know, sort of like we said last week, yes, Philip brought up this really bad dish and the potatoes were gummy, but at the end of the day, Karen and Jillian and Giselle Giselle did not cook a good dish, and so she took the brunt of the axe because of that. And that sort of happened here as well, where, like, yes, you can come up with a bad concept, but if you can't cook simple food to begin with, I feel like that is more of a sticking point, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, we did get that from Tom this episode, the quote where he basically says, at the end of the day, the worst cooked dish is going to send somebody home. And that is ultimately what with Wesley was. It was pretty funny. Wesley said, I'm just hoping somebody cooks something gross. And watch where you're pointing your fingers, Wesley, because several are pointing right back at you. And that was unfortunate. He knew it. I think Wesley's a champ in my book. He took it like a champ. He took the feedback like a champ. He admitted that, you know, the pressure of following Richard Blais and cooking for Richard Blais, having never met him, got to him a little bit. Getting Richard's beer was a bad deal for him. I agree with you, Kurt, that I felt like it was pretty straightforward. Wesley said, I'm going home, repeatedly. He said, I'm in the bottom. Jason came back in the room and said, does anybody think they're in the bottom? Wesley raised his hand. And Wesley is the guy who goes home. And that's pretty rough. I think we've talked a ton on this podcast about how this season seems to be full of people with a whole lot of talent, even more so than other previous seasons. We did get kind of a great sort of weird, like Obi-Wan kind of moment with Emeril, where he came into the house with some wine and talked to him. We had somebody say he kind of felt like a deity left the room when Emeril left. And I think that that's a great moment. And I think that Emeril has reflected on the quality of the competition. I think other people involved really are seeing this season as a season of really quality chefs across the board. We're not getting a ton of people who really don't feel like they deserve to be there. And I certainly felt like Wesley deserved to be there, but he just never really adjusted to the competition. And I don't know if any of you guys caught this. I laughed really hard when he's packing his knives and they're doing the thing.
Oh, yeah.
They edited in a crash box at the end, didn't they?
Yeah, when he walked off screen. Again, the Top Chef editors were in peak condition this episode.
It was a big, like, wet, hot American summer call out.
It really was.
It was awesome. So that was great. That was great.
You mentioned the Emeril visit, and we talked a little bit last week about those kind of interstitial, you know, 30-second clips that you'll sometimes see peppered amongst the commercials. And that felt a little bit like that to me. I mean, you know, when they were handing out the beers on the pier, I pretty much knew right away, okay, this is the start of a challenge. These beers mean something. And the moment that you see, like, one of the chefs, you know, arrive at a place where you don't expect them to, like if Padma visits them or Emeril visits them, I actually was personally expecting there to be some sort of twist with Emeril's visit. And it seemed to me strange, but it was interesting to see, that it was, no, he was just there to kind of chat and say, hey, what's up? I was expecting there to be a little bit more to it than that, but I was glad. I was kind of glad that there wasn't. It was a nice moment to see.
Yeah, I was afraid Emerald was going to come in and say, like, okay, now here's a bottle of wine for you to also include elements of in your meal.
Yep.
Yeah. And Chad's like, just stop.
I can't take this anymore. Now you're going to tell me to make a cocktail. This is ridiculous.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, I don't know. I thought that too. Emerald's rolling in there with like six bottles of wine. I thought for sure, like, we're going to get, like, you have to also pair your meal with this bottle of wine, because people that are eating at restaurants now, they're going to have beer and wine because they want to try the beer, but they also want to try wine. So this is what you're dealing with. So you're going to have to cook like that. But it never happened. And I'm thankful it didn't happen. Sometimes Top
you
Chef.
You have to drink an entire bottle of wine each before you cook this next challenge.
Now that would have been, I think, probably more representative of what being a chef is really like.
And Chad, to make up for you not drinking, you're gonna have to spin on this dizzy bat about 20 times before
we're gonna need 30 dizzy izzies from Chad.
Or have him wear beer goggles throughout.
And here are some mushrooms to eat.
We are also just gonna force you to drink the wine.
Yes. And yeah, we're just gonna pour it right down your throat
against your convictions and personal demons.
Yeah. So anyway, I do think that that's interesting, that we could have ended up with that kind of challenge. Sometimes Top Chef does go too far. Not yet have we seen them make the chefs get drunk, but they've sleep deprived the chefs. They've made the chefs continue cooking through a day where they stayed up the night before. They've done a lot of those things before, so we're not that far from it, I don't think. And there's a possibility that we could end up there at some point, maybe like on a New Year's celebration or some kind of silly thing like that, where they have a bunch of champagne first, and then they tell them, now it's time for a quick fire. I think that would be a fun thing to do. So
I feel like legal's got something to say about that.
Yeah, maybe. Depends on, there's no fire. But then it's a quick no fire. It's just a quick.
Let's not talk about fire right now.
Sorry, Josh. Sorry. Apologies. I don't want to break any circuits here. So let's continue. I don't know. Anything else to say about the bottom? We talked about the bottom a fair amount, but we haven't really talked about the top. But I want to make sure that if anybody else had anything to say about the bottom three, that we cover it. The bottom three, again, we had Wesley. We had Isaac, unfortunately, for my team. And then we had Jason. And we've talked about Jason's issues extensively. Any other issues with the bottom three before we finish with the top?
I feel like Marjorie's faults here kind of went a little unsung this episode, where she had tried using a pressure cooker for the first time. And we've seen chefs try new things for the first time throughout the season. I mean, Giselle was the one who had never made chicken wings before in episode two, and it actually turned out really well. But Marjorie here, granted, you know, there was this little catastrophe where she thought that she had not put the lid right on her pressure cooker, and that could have affected things. So it turned out to be fine, though that turned out not to be the case at all. It was that she didn't really include any sort that the dish didn't taste like beer despite her cooking the ingredients in the beer. And so I feel like she was probably right there at the bottom, probably teetering in that fourth to last place. But, you know, we could have very easily seen her on the bottom with those guys.
And potentially Carl as well, because it sounded like the commentary, maybe it was from Richard about Carl's dish, was that, you know, sometimes if you create a dish to pair almost too closely with a beer or a wine, that sometimes the flavors will cancel each other out. It seemed to be that he was saying that's what had happened. I wasn't completely sure if you're saying, and you just avoided that, is this was perfect. But they did say it needed more salt, but it almost seemed like they were saying that the pairing was almost too close and some of the flavors canceled each other out. So I was a little worried for Carl as well.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the best week for chefs who have done well in previous competitions. And you're right, Mike, we didn't see the kind of pressure cooker thing come back to bite Marjorie, but her dish was right on the line of the, where did you conceptualize the dish properly for the challenge? And I think that if other chefs had cooked really good dishes, we could have seen Marjorie in the bottom. But thankfully for her, I guess, there were some chefs that had made some mistakes with their concepts or their prep, and that's why they ended up on the bottom. And so Marjorie didn't end up there, even though we did have some negative comments about Marjorie. But there were some chefs who did really well with this challenge, obviously. Personally, I felt like the way the episode was edited, that this was going to be a runaway for Kwame. We had them basically saying, this is a home run. I think we had Tom say, Kwame, your dish would stand up anywhere. Kwame's tasting his dish saying it's delicious. When it's being tasted, they're saying it's amazing. But Kwame doesn't win. Karen wins. Karen's dish also, apparently the beet sauce, Tom says, is an ingredient where it's just one of those things that you want to eat over and over and over again. So it must have been really, really, really good.
I wonder also, maybe Karen got the edge on Kwame because she did have Richard's beer, and Richard, as we just talked about, kind of might have purposely threw in some really weird ingredients, and considering that she was able to make a lot more out of what she was given, then, you know, Kwame had the banana as sort of a curveball, but he turned that as a concept of his dish into his whole sofrito. And we had that story about how he ate at this restaurant in the Bronx and he had a sofrito, and that's what he was going to base it off of. But maybe they said, okay, Karen had the biggest obstacles working against her going into the challenge, so we're going to commend her more for being able to turn that into a great dish.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, the Padma's beer didn't put anybody on the top or the bottom. And the other beers, you know, had varying degrees of success there one way or the other. So it is interesting that Karen did really well with Richard's beer. She did really well specifically with the beet portion of it. And I felt like it was also interesting that all three chefs that cooked with Richard's beer or using Richard's beer kind of cooked with beets, that we saw a beet kind of puree from all three of them. And beets were a really key ingredient. So it maybe seemed like, even though he was giving them a lot of stuff to play with, that the beet was just such a thing that they had to feature, and they all featured in a very similar way. But Karen's was really good. So Karen wins. This is great. I think this is a great development for the season. We have now, I think, multiple different winners for the elimination challenges. I know Marjorie won one. I know Kwame's won them. Jeremy's won them. I know Karen's won them. So we're in really, I think, great position now for what's shaping up to be a really good season. I think the thing that's going to put it over the top is, can Chef Philip stay alive long enough to captain a team?
Please, yes.
I got an idea for you guys. We're just going to put everything on the floor, buffet style.
I just want to hear his concept.
If the restaurant is not called Bun, I'm going to flip out.
Well, because Philip's entire, like, quote unquote sob stories, or at least the things that we find out about Philip, are all about his restaurants. You know, I cooked for Bonnaroo. I'm opening another restaurant. It's going through financial troubles. My restaurant is doing well. Like, Philip doesn't really have personal matters as much as he just has restaurant matters. And so I feel like I agree. He has to be brought to Restaurant Wars. It's going to be poetic.
That's the kind of thing where, like, you're saying, like, Joe is bringing up, like, I got to make it to the family visit. I got to make it to the family visit. And that's in the show, because he's going to make it to the family visit. You got to feel like Philip is getting to Restaurant Wars, and it's going to be a spectacular explosion.
I'm hoping he does front of house too, that he planned the entire concept and menu front of house.
I'm glad we're all in agreement on this. This is my dream for this season. And if we don't see it happen, I'm going to be very disappointed, even though we've had a very great season so far. And it's shaping up to be a good one for the rest of it. If we don't see Chef Philip in Restaurant Wars, butting heads with people, throwing off the wall concepts out there, plating on rocks, who knows what, you know, buffet on the ground, whatever it is.
Well, I think we have, what, 9 people left in the competition and 1 in Last Chance Kitchen. So Restaurant Wars usually
happens right around
at 8.
The bend. Here's
you
the
might
thing.
See it happen
it
in
would
a couple
be great
weeks.
To see Captain Philip. He's the captain now. It'd be great to see that. Is there any universe where these people allow him to be in charge? If they do that, they do so thinking, well, this is going to be his chance to explode.
If he has a horrible week the previous week and feels a strong need to redeem himself,
and just,
I can see
and just being like, fine, we'll roll with that with under that. The assumption that he's probably going to screw up and he's going to go home for it.
I'm hoping so. I don't know. Maybe I just want him as captain.
Yeah, well, also, let's remember that I think even last season, Restaurant Wars captains were determined by knife draw. So there's a very good chance they could just do a random pick and Philip would end up with the key spot there.
A quote-unquote random pick.
I think that,
Philip,
you know,
was told to pick the cold knife.
No matter how it shakes out, like, if Philip is, if he's the captain of a team or if he's not the captain of the team, that could be really fun as well, where he just wants to be heard and he's not being heard. I think that the key point is Philip has to hit Restaurant Wars.
Yep, you got to see it.
Yeah, especially because I think there was some debate last time about, you know, it even came up at the beginning of this episode. So, you know, so what if the dish I described to you, my mashed potato dish, wasn't exactly how it turned out? That shouldn't have affected any of you guys. Here's an instance where if he goes rogue with a dish, the restaurant has to be this holistic concept. And if he does go rogue and does pull a Philip, you know, that is going to impact the entire team. You have some great, great opportunity for some fireworks there.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Kurt. I will say we did see the sort of pop-up restaurant wars earlier this season with Philip and the vegan kind of concept and talking about cooking vegan dishes at his restaurant. And that was unquestionably the worst of the four. And so there's already been just sort of great kind of established restaurant war startup with the pop-up kind of challenge that we had already. Now the concept was a little more baked in there, so we didn't get a lot of the beating heads over where are we going to start, what are we going to do. But we've already seen some glory in that regard from Philip and his sort of vegan restaurant that, oh, I cook vegan all the time, this will be great. and it just went so poorly. So this, we've already seen it happen. This could be good if we see it play out on a larger scale. Wesley leaves. I thought this was great. We got a round of applause for Wesley as he's walking out. Yeah. And then we did get the glass/ceramic breaking noise from Wet Hot American Summer as he ultimately exits the kitchen, which made me laugh really, really hard. Anything else about the episode before we transition into Last Chance Kitchen, guys?
No, let's go into Last Chance Kitchen. And actually, Josh, I'm intrigued to hear your thoughts about Grayson, because, you know, everyone's heard our opinions about how we were a little WTF mate on why Grayson was back and how she got back and the way she behaved specifically in the first just couple
the,
weeks.
The Russell, I mean, Swan of
on your team unintentionally. She's calling Tom Lord. She gets eliminated in this episode, but in general, what are your thoughts about like Grayson's appearance here? And do you have any
theories? No, I mean, I think that she was terrific television when she was on her first time. She wasn't a bad cook. I mean, she wasn't, you know, she wasn't the greatest chef in the room or anything like that, but she wasn't bad at all. I think certainly she felt like she could have done well. We've seen people return to the show in sort of these weird one-off appearances before. It's not unusual for this to happen. And I think that Grayson is a big enough character in Top Chef lore that it's fun to see her back on the show. That being said, obviously did not go the way that she wanted it to go. And she was very, very, very quickly frustrated in a very explicit, outward, impossible to ignore way. And I think once that started happening, you just knew it was going to be a bad ending. It was just a matter of when it was going to unravel. So it unraveled on the show fairly recently. It unravels at LCK this week. That's sad. I would have liked to have seen her rock Last Chance Kitchen for a while. I think that she's great television. I think she's very funny. But she's just not destined to win Top Chef. I think that would, if I were, you know, putting together another all-star season at some point in the future, I doubt that Grayson's getting the call. I think that the people who are making the show and the host, Padma, Tom, they seemed pretty frustrated with her. So I don't expect to see any more Grayson anytime soon, aside from, you know, helping out on this season.
Well, it seemed like, well, they were frustrated and a little kind of put off by her attitude. It seems like her and Tom had a really great relationship in terms of Last Chance Kitchen, or at least, and we talked a little bit last week about how Last Chance Kitchen has this almost a completely different tone to it.
But it's sponsored by Hidden Valley Ranch and Spice Mix.
So I was surprised to see the level of camaraderie that Tom and Grayson seem to have in Last Chance Kitchen, given the
totally. And I mean, I think that comes down to what is the production time between Top Chef and Last Chance Kitchen? When is Last Chance Kitchen happening? How much time does Grayson have to cool off from being a total dunce on Top Chef proper? I would imagine it's not, you know, you're off the show and now you're on LCK. I think that there's some time in between.
Agreed.
Yeah, probably. And we don't know how much, but it's certainly an ongoing thing, and it's not clear this season where Last Chance Kitchen's even being held. I mean, sometimes you got to think that these chefs are probably centrally located, probably in Los Angeles. And so maybe if you get eliminated in San Francisco, you got a couple days to get down to LA, and then maybe a week later. I mean, I don't know to what extent they sequester these chef testants. I don't really know what the deal is with how the Last Chance Kitchen works, but there's definitely some time period that has passed. It's unquestionable. And in this particular instance, we had two chefs come in. And so whether or not they knew each other right away, whether they came in at the same time, what anybody knew, we don't know. But walking into Last Chance Kitchen, we've got Angelina, who was eliminated in the sudden death quick fire. And then we've got Wesley coming in fresh off the crash box after packing his knives. And then they're cooking against Chef Grayson. Neither of them seem to be surprised to see her. We've talked a lot about one of the kind of fun things about Last Chance Kitchen is when the Last Chance Kitchen challenge is based around the eliminated chef's reason for elimination. Like, well, you did really poorly with scallops, so now you have to use scallops in your dish or whatever it is. Hard to do that when you have two people be eliminated, even though Angelina and Wesley participated in the Caesar challenge, both of them. They went home for different reasons. And so there really isn't a clear reason why they went home. So we just kind of fall back to a burger challenge. And it plays out kind of perhaps unexpectedly. Mike, how does the Last Chance Kitchen play out here? And were you satisfied with the result?
Yeah, so basically, these three go out to make the best burger they can. I mean, Tom outlines things a little bit, gives a little bit of given circumstances here, where Angelina, and Tom has actually been to Angelina's restaurant in Miami. He points out that she has a burger on her menu, though, you know, she had Taco Tuesdays, as she talked about earlier in the episode, and that didn't stop her from getting, you know, not plating the dish. He also makes a pretty mean crack at Wesley, I feel like, where he says, like, oh, and Wesley, yeah, you probably had a burger or two from the way you're looking, which I thought was actually pretty mean on Tom's part.
Yeah, he made a fat joke. That's rude.
Yeah, but so basically what they do is Wesley goes with this really interesting angle of redemption where he decides, I'm going to make a burger basically using the dish that kind of sent me home. So he makes a lamb burger with Ra's al Ghul, goat cheese and fennel and jalapeno onion slaw. Angelina decides to go, I don't know if this is the same burger that she cooked in her restaurant, but she goes with a beef and pork burger with avocado, heirloom tomatoes, pickled habanero, and arugula. Keeping it simple, of course, in typical Angelina style. Grayson is a little more flummoxed. She tries to do a beef and pork belly burger, but she finds that the pork belly is not ground up. So she has to actually take time to put the pork belly into the grinder. And when she does that, it's not the consistency that she wants. And I believe when Tom does their check-in at like 8 minutes left, she hasn't even cooked the burger yet. So I don't know. I was hopeful for Grayson because she had won two Last Chance Kitchens at this point, but I don't know. I think she was kind of slow out of the gate to begin with, and that kind of put her at a distant third place in this competition overall.
Yeah, I think it's tough. You know, the deal with making a burger, there are a lot of things that can go wrong, obviously. And just because you eat them doesn't mean you know how to make them. And, you know, you have to, it seems like the texture of the burger, whether it was too compacted or not, really was a key issue here. And Angelina also seemed to cook hers to medium, better than the other two chefs. And that's a big deal for people who really like burgers. If you cook them, if you hammer them, if you cook them too much and they don't have their juices left and they're dry, then it's not what you want. So she seemed to do a really good job with the burger. And I think full marks given to Angelina here.
Agreed. And it seemed like, you know, even though, you know, I have to somewhat support him because he was on my team and I was rooting for Wesley, he did seem to try to throw a little bit of shade at Angelina's, at how the burger was done. And I like that Tom did say, actually, no, I think this burger looks perfectly cooked, actually.
No, wasn't that Grayson?
Sorry, you're right. It was Wesley. He said he looked over. Wesley actually, yeah, rewind. Wesley said he looked over and when Tom had sliced it open, he's like, that looks perfectly cooked. You're right. It was Grayson who was throwing some shade.
Grayson had no hard soft feelings towards, or no soft feelings, tasty. Maybe no soft on soft feelings yeah. towards Angelina. And maybe it's because, as she pointed out, she was part of that team with Angelina. And one would argue that Grayson took the blame for their dish that ultimately sent her home. But between that comment that you just pointed out, Kurt, and also like when after all, they all tried theirs and Tom asked them, okay, whose did you like? Wesley points to Angelina and Grayson says, oh, it was too spicy. I don't like spice, but I thought it was too spicy. And you could tell that even when Grayson was eliminated on her way out, she says, you know, I am pissed because I feel like I keep leaving the kitchen and Angelina's still there. So it's clear that I think she still holds some resentment there.
Good point.
Yeah, but you know what? Do? Sorry, Grayson. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what else to say. Like, it is what it is.
What are you going
to
do?
This is what you signed up for, and I'm sorry it didn't work out the way that you wanted it to, but it didn't. And some of that is definitely on Grayson, and that's tough. I don't know. I think she's a better chef than what she showed on this season of Top Chef and Last Chance Kitchen. I think we saw that from her the first time around. I just think she's a much better chef than what she ultimately got to do here. And I don't know. Just what you were saying, Josh and Mike, what you were talking about. We don't know what the circumstances were that brought her back, what she expected, what the intent was, but it didn't work out well for her. And it didn't work out well for CJ when he came back.
Became LCK,
then he dominated.
Became LCJK.
And really,
except it was no joke.
Exactly. He did really well. And then he ended up winning the Top Chef battles, that one season of that show that they did. So CJ, after his sort of didn't work out really well his second time around. He got a lot of redemption and got a redemption arc out of that. Grayson did have a couple of wins here in Last Chance Kitchen. She beat my friend Garrett, and she beat someone else there in the middle.
Giselle.
I can't remember, Giselle. But, you know, it just wasn't really that much of a redemption for Grayson. And you're right. You guys are right. On her way out the door, she's still complaining. So I'm sorry that the experience didn't work out for her, because I really did like her the first time around. And it's a shame that it's not as good the second time around.
Yeah. And you, going back to the structure for Last Chance Kitchen, it's like, I haven't investigated it. I don't have any inside scoop here, but I almost get the impression that it's filmed maybe over a 3-day period. Like, the episode before, or like right before the person actually has to go back in the competition. So I've a feeling that, you know, right after Grayson beat Giselle last week, there's maybe, you know, a 2-hour break, and then they bring in the next group of people. But I have a feeling it's kind of taped in a marathon session over a week or so.
I don't know. I feel like it's got to be some sort of time before the finals. I don't know. I feel like the production would fear creating too much of a backlog of eliminated players. I don't know. I personally have a feeling that they sort of still try to tie it in. Maybe they bust the eliminated players immediately down to LA, where Last Chance Kitchen is being held, and everyone just sort of hangs around. I guess one good thing about Grayson leaving is that she's going to join our ever-growing, colorful cast of characters that make up this peanut gallery, which, Josh, you were talking before about how you felt that a lot of the big personalities were eliminated early, and we definitely agree with that. But at least we get to see them here on Last Chance Kitchen asking people what they're making.
Good idea. Which I gotta say, I still don't like.
Wait. We didn't hear Francis saying, "You can do it," over and over again this time.
Yeah, Francis didn't get the peanut gallery was not the same this time. They were not the centerpiece. There were three chefs here. So maybe when we go back to two, we're going to get more peanuts.
Speaking of that, like, did any of you, like, up until the point that Tom declared one of you is going to go on, did any of you potentially think that maybe for the rest of the Last Chance Kitchen run, there'd be a top two moving forward? Or did you pretty much have nailed down, they're going to have three people go in, one person leaves?
No, I think they learned sort of like the way Survivor learned from Redemption Island to go into South Pacific to only have one person move on. I feel like, because I think in Top Chef Seattle, didn't they do that whole thing about like the save where it was like a chef that was eliminated in Last Chance Kitchen, people voted on them and they still continued on in the competition. I think they realized that it was just sloppy to do that. And the best way moving forward was just say, okay, one person moves forward every time just to keep things as clean as possible.
Yeah, maybe that was just my wishful thinking that there'd be a greater chance for Wesley to stick around. But I have to say, I didn't come into this thinking, Angelina is going to be the one that actually survives this.
Yeah,
this,
me too. And she's on my team, and I should be rooting for her, but she's so bad that it's hard to root for her, and yet she won. It's amazing.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like, and we talked before with Amar about, like, you know, how much constraints of challenges have effects, have affectations on people. I feel like Angelina is someone that easily got rattled by circumstances of the competition. This is a very easy Last Chance Kitchen challenge. As you talked about before, Antonio, it wasn't a challenge that was like, okay, you got eliminated because of this, so therefore you have to do this. It was just more of a general thing to accommodate both her and Wesley. So we'll see next week if she has to cook things to the specifications of the way someone else was eliminated. I do not think she'll do well.
Yeah, she never did really find her footing in this competition. And she was able to knock out a pretty good burger, good looking burger, good tasting burger in the time constraints there. But she has not typically done well with developing complex flavors and complex dishes in the quick fire constraint, which, to be fair, I think for a lot of chefs seems to be the issue with Top Chef, is that just the timing alone is really nightmarish. And that's something that Angelina seemed to struggle with. I mean, she didn't even get her tacos on the plate. So it just is something that has rattled her throughout. And when we do see a challenge that's designed, whoever gets eliminated next, it could be an issue for Angelina. I agree completely. I don't think she's bad by any stretch. I think that it would be very interesting to see Angelina back on Top Chef in like 10 years when she's aged up and had a lot more experience and expanded her worldview beyond the experience that she's had. Because for her to be there in the kind of position she's in and at her age is interesting. And I think it makes for the kind of contestant who, if you're going to bring people back later, there's a story to tell there. I'm not sure that they ever will tell it. I'm not sure that she's earned a spot like that. But if she ever came back, I would feel that she would have a much more interesting story to tell than the story we got with Grayson, which I didn't really understand why she was back. I didn't understand why Grayson was having a second chance, guys. I didn't know what her second chance story was. I can already see what Angelina's is.
No, the casuals voted her on, so it's questionable at best.
Yeah. So anyway, R.I.P. to Grayson. I guess pour out a glass for Grayson. No more Top Chef for Grayson. At least it certainly doesn't seem like it. Third time's a charm for Grayson. Anybody interested in seeing Grayson again?
Good.
Yeah, me neither. All right. Well, I think that about wraps it up. So unless anybody has anything else that they want to talk about from this episode.
I'm good.
No. Well, if you like what we're doing here at the Top Chef Judges Table, you can always subscribe to the general feed for reality wrap-ups. You can go to robhasawebsite.com/wrap-ups, R-H-A-P-U-P-S. That will get you the feed for all the things that we talk about on the reality wrap-ups portion of Rob Has a Website and Rob Has a Podcast. That is not only Top Chef, but we're also talking about The Bachelor current season, the MTV Challenge current season. There's also the weekly Our Happy Hour with Jordan Parhar from Big Brother Canada. So there are a lot of shows that we're doing just within the context of this feed. And so if you're interested in getting all those shows or having an RSS feed for the Top Chef episodes, that's how you get it. robhasawebsite.com/wrap-ups. You can also interact with us on Twitter. We would love to hear your comments or thoughts on this episode. I'm at AC Mazzaro, 2 Z's, 1 R. Yeah. Josh is at Round Howard. That's correct, right, Josh? Yeah, and Kurt is at Kurt Clark. Pretty simple stuff. And then Mike is at A Mike Bloom Type for your casting needs. At A Mike Bloom Type. Guys, do we have a hashtag you want to send out to anybody? People that can send us to show that they're interested in talking about this episode? Or
Kurt's laughing. Mike's laughing.
Kurt, you're laughing. Why are you laughing? That's why I went to Kurt first, if I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, I've got a few. I think we want to... avoid hashtag unintentional mayonnaise guy, even though I'm still intrigued by Mike's comment.
Well, so we'll save that for the after show.
Yeah. Yes. And as much as I'd like to, I think there's a nice Zero Dark Chad comment from Josh earlier. I'm really intrigued by Big Dougie. It's a nice,
tribute it's a compliment to Wesley. Too. We love Dougie.
Hashtag Big Dougie. Did you have any? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I like Big Dougie. I was going to go, I didn't want to exploit Josh's misfortune too much, but I was going to go with hashtag stove scare. But I think Big Dougie could work in this case.
Yeah. Stove scare. We had a stove scare in the middle of the podcast, and we always have those on Top Chef. But yeah, hashtag Big Dougie. Let's give a shout out to Wesley, Chef Wesley, who likes his burgers and his butt cracks. Hashtag Big Dougie. So. Yeah, thank you guys very much for listening to this Stitched Together Emergency Happening Crazy Things in the Middle of podcast at the Top Chef Judges Table here at Reality Wrap Ups. We're very thankful for your participation in listening, and we'd love to hear your thoughts and comments on this episode and this podcast. Thanks, everybody.